Think about a new addition to the family today. Welcome as we take another look into the life and message of Elizabeth Elliot, who called us to live to a higher standard every day and not be satisfied with just a little empty religion in life. That's a shallow substitute for what God wants us to have. Well, as our series continues in the coming weeks, we'll hear from family, friends, and others who were influenced by Elizabeth's life and message. Hey, it's good to have you with us again today, or for the first time. Special welcome to you. Well, let's see where we are. We're about halfway through the Call to Motherhood series, parts 9 and 10 today, as we think about continuing a pregnancy and a question and answer session, including Valerie Elliott Shepherd, some thoughts on homeschooling, and we may get into some other topics as well. Also, we'll hear from a niece of Elizabeth, Andrea Hawthorne. As we think about motherhood and family life, we'll be hearing about some advice that Elizabeth gave to her niece, Andrea. That coming later, but right now it's part 9 of The Call to Motherhood, Continuing a Pregnancy.
You are loved with an everlasting love. That's what the Bible says. And underneath are the everlasting arms. This is your friend, Elizabeth Elliot, talking with you today about continuing a pregnancy. I was absolutely shocked when a young woman told me that when she went into the doctor's office to learn whether or not she was pregnant, his first question was, "Do you want to continue this pregnancy?" My friend was absolutely thrilled that she was pregnant, but she discovered in questioning the doctor that this is a routine question which is asked of every patient. Do you want to continue this pregnancy? Someone sent me an article from the New York Times, which I was amazed to see in a periodical like that, but I applaud everything this young woman says. It starts with this statement: "This child I carry, like my other two, is wanted, healthy or not." She tells us that she's 36 years old, expecting a baby, and soon after the congratulations and was it an accident, her friends asked whether or not she was having amniocentesis. The assumption being that she was. Amniocentesis, for those who might not be familiar with the term, is a method of examining the amniotic fluid in the mother's womb in such a way as to be able to tell if certain diseases are present. It can detect certain kinds of abnormalities. And if those abnormalities are detected, then the general assumption is that the woman will want to have an abortion. This lady, whose name was Anna Quindlen, says, "The reality is that I am not having amnio. I've had a good long time to think about it, knowing since the birth of my second that I wanted more children and that I would slip into the danger zone over the age of 35 before I became pregnant again. My husband and I have had some good long talks about it, about how much stress and disappointment our family could stand, about when life begins and under what circumstances it should be ended. While some people use amniocentesis to prepare for bad news, for most it is an issue of abortion. You have the test so that you can find out if the child will be impaired, and if it will, you can, well, what I'm supposed to write here is terminate the pregnancy. But that's not what I feel. If I were talking about doing something as clinical as terminating something as disembodied as a pregnancy, I wouldn't have a problem." That's the end of the quotation from Anna Quindlen's article in the New York Times. And I'm delighted to know that there is a woman who has the courage to speak about terms like terminating and pregnancy. She says that's not what she's thinking about. She is carrying a child. It's not merely a pregnancy. And you don't terminate a child. She says, "Perhaps if this child were unwanted, I could think of it as a fetus. But my children, three of them now, have all been wanted. They were babies from the moment I knew they were coming. I do not know what it would take for me to stop their lives." And just this morning, I was listening to TV on the discussion about whether or not there might be the overturning of the Roe versus Wade decision back in 1973, which legalized abortion. And, of course, I and thousands of others are praying that there may be a change in those laws. The article goes on to say that she hasn't a clue what she and her husband could handle. In other words, if the process of amniocentesis should reveal abnormalities in the child that she's carrying, I haven't a clue what I could handle. I do know that I would have blighted my life if I had turned away from all the things I thought I was not big enough to do. Isn't that a great point for us mothers to ponder? Did you know what you were getting into when you had a child? Could you possibly imagine all that it was going to entail? Would you have felt that you were big enough to do it? Of course not. And that's the way it is with a good many things that turn out to be the will of God for us. We're not big enough. We can't handle it by ourselves. But that's what God is there for. He's waiting for us to acknowledge our need of Him. And although this woman does not get into anything that reveals as to whether or not she's a Christian, she's an intelligent and honest enough woman to recognize that she would blight her life if she turned away from all the things that she thought she was not big enough to do. And she ends by this paragraph: "The first two children have taught us that life is nothing but hard questions, and that we answer them as best we can. In some sense, the future is already written. This child is already something: boy, girl, healthy, ill. Perhaps if you are a devotee of nature over nurture, even good or bad. I do not know yet. I know only one thing now. This child is ours, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health." And I had a letter from friends of ours who had just received the word that the wife is pregnant with a child who has been shown to have spina bifida through the process of amniocentesis. Well, that news would be hard for anybody to take. It was particularly hard for this couple to take because they already have a child suffering from spina bifida. And so I wrote this letter to them. "How often the two of you have been in my thoughts and prayers since we heard the news of the tiny child that Kathy is now carrying. God has trusted you with a great trust, and I do not doubt He will carry you through the deep waters through which He calls you to go, and through the fiery furnace. In the words of the hymn, 'The flame shall not hurt thee. I only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine.' Do we have to go for the gold, you may be asking, and of course, you know the answer. Yes, it will be worth it all, and so far more than worth it, that it is quite unimaginable now. Will there be enough grace, enough strength, enough wisdom available for you as father and mother of two handicapped children? You know the source. He has not moved from where he's been all along, with Joseph in his pit, Daniel in the lion's den, Shadrach and his friends in the furnace, John the Baptist in prison, Paul in his shipwrecks, Christ on his cross, and you in this dark place. Samuel Rutherford has always said so much better what I need to say, so let me give you his words to a woman in deep sorrow, back in 1634. The Lord hath pierced the vessel. It will be known whether there be in it wine or water. Let your faith and patience be seen, that it may be known your only beloved, first and last, hath been Christ." And Rutherford goes on to say, "And I dare say God's hammering of you from your youth is only to make you a fair carved stone in the high upper temple of the New Jerusalem. Your Lord never thought this world's painted glory a gift worthy of you, and therefore would not bestow it on you, because he is to propine, which means to hold out a gift to you, with a better portion." And so I wrote to these friends of mine, who were not for a second considering abortion, but simply trying to prepare themselves for a second spina bifida child. I wrote these words, hoping that Rutherford's words and the words from the old hymn, "The flame shall not hurt thee, I only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine," would be a help to them. And I think again of the mystery of charity. When we talk about love, we're not talking about that soupy, silly sentiment that the movies are about. We're talking about that eternal love which comes only from God, the kind which is stronger than death, the kind that many waters cannot quench, and the kind of love that a mother has for a child or a father has for his child is love which gives itself, love which sacrifices, love which is willing to be inconvenienced. Maybe that's the best way for us to put it. Maybe we need to think about the fact that children are, of course, an inconvenience. Any kind of love is an inconvenience because it takes time, doesn't it? It makes many demands on us. But the love which is willing to be inconvenienced, that's perhaps the simplest statement. And then, of course, it takes us into much deeper waters than mere inconveniences. But the measure of our maturity is the measure of our self-giving. And the measure of our self-giving is the measure of our fulfillment. How much will you allow God to do in and through you? If I'm speaking to anyone today who is considering terminating a pregnancy, I would earnestly ask you, in the name of Jesus, reconsider. Receive this child in his name. Even if you're not married, give birth to that child. Then ask God to give you wisdom about whether to keep that child, or perhaps to turn it over to a Christian center that will help you find a couple who will adopt it, a Christian couple who can give that child a home. Are you willing to be inconvenienced for the sake of a child?
Part 9 of The Call to Motherhood, Continuing a Pregnancy. Well, we'll be hearing from Valerie Shepherd later, Elizabeth's daughter, about some areas of discipline. But right now, let's hear from Andrea Hawthorne, the niece of Elizabeth Elliot. As we've been thinking about motherhood and family life, what did Elizabeth have to say to her niece about meeting a man someday, maybe getting married?
I remember visiting her one time when she lived on the East Coast and would have been married to Lars at that time. And I think I was done college, or I was somewhere in that time of my life. And I had always wanted to be a wife and a mother. That was my desire. And I was walking on the beach with her, and I was being all angsty about that and saying, I want to meet a man and I don't think it's going to happen. And she just very calmly looked at me and said, "Well, Andrea, we don't really need to worry about that, do we? That is in the Lord's hands." And that kind of brought that conversation to a close very quickly.
Thank you, Andrea. Andrea Hawthorne, the niece of Elizabeth Elliot. Later on, we'll hear from Elizabeth's daughter, Valerie, as she tells us about delayed obedience. Right now, we go to part 10 of The Call to Motherhood. It's a question and answer session, and at least one of the topics is homeschooling. Have you ever thought about doing that?
People are always asking me, Val, why does your daughter homeschool? Is it because she thinks the schools are so terrible? Is that the main reason?
No, I don't think that's the main reason. The main reason is we want to see godly character developed in our children. And it seems to me the best way to see that developed is to keep them at home as long as possible. We see them learning responsibility and learning to love their brothers and sisters and learning to be loyal to each other. Whereas I know that if they were in school, they would be more loyal to their peers and less loyal to their brothers and sisters, and they would disdain being with them. So we believe God wants us to do it, at least for now. We don't know how long we're going to do it, but godly characteristics and godly values are what we're trying to instill in them, and it seems that
I think you lent me a book one time. I've forgotten what the title of it was, but it told about some studies in child psychology which indicate that a child is more likely to absorb and retain the values of the parents if he stays home with them up until the age of what? 7, 8?
Usually 10. 8 to 10, anywhere between 8 to 10. Just depends on the amount of time that is spent with other people. If the child has the majority of time spent with his parents, then he's going to listen more to his parents than he is to his peers. But if the child is spending 6 or 7 hours a day with peers and with only one adult, then if he's below the age of 10, he will just latch on to whatever the crowd is saying.
Another question that often is asked of me, and I would like to hear your answer to this one, but don't your children need to be with peers? Don't they miss out socially?
No, I don't think they do at all. I think the best socialization for any child is to be in a family. And I think they learn respect for adults because they're with their mother most of the time, and they learn love and unselfishness with the younger brothers or older brothers and sisters, whereas if they were with peers all the time, they would learn mostly the bad values of the children. And socialization when in a peer group is usually me first and getting in line first and having my way and
competition,
all that sort of thing. Whereas we're in the home, it's more like life because you're with older and younger people that you have to learn to get along with.
So it's not quite as artificial a situation as if you've got 36-year-olds all together or 38-year-olds in one place.
Right.
There has to be more give and take. And I certainly see that when I visit in your home. I see that the older children have to pay attention to the younger ones, and the younger ones are taken care of and watched over in ways which, of course, they don't by any means always appreciate, do they? But it does amaze me, and it amazes me every time I visit, that anything at all gets done. This morning when I was teaching, trying to help Elizabeth and Walter, the two oldest, with a grammar lesson on ellipses and the subjects of sentences, the two-year-old came in a couple of times. The two-year-old and the four-year-old chased each other through the room a few times. The cats wandered around. Phone rang. The doorbell rang. Baby was crying upstairs for a few minutes until you went and fed her. But, of course, I was there. Mm-hmm. And the question that is always in my mind when I leave, having been quite busy every minute when I'm with you, is what does Val do by herself? And people are always saying to me, well, how many children is she homeschooling? Uh-huh. Tell us that.
Okay, my oldest is in sixth grade, and the second one is in fourth grade, and the third one is in first grade. So I only give those three assignments for the day, and they often do a lot of their work on their own. And the first grader is learning a lot from her older sister. And in fact, the older sister really wants to teach her basic English grammar and punctuation and capitalization and that kind of thing. So the only thing that I really spend a lot of time on teaching the older two is grammar. That's what you did this morning. And as I said, they do most on their own.
Now, what about the four-year-old? Does he absorb anything by osmosis?
If he hears us when Christiana and I might be doing addition flashcards or subtraction, and if he's around us and we're saying things over and over again, he'll pick things up and say them too, you know. And sometimes he'll be talking. I've heard Colleen talking about adjectives and adverbs because she's heard me talking with Walter and Elizabeth about
Colleen
it.
Colleen
is 2 years old. I have some little workbooks for Jim, the four-year-old, to work on. At the beginning of the school year, he was all excited about working on them at his little desk, but he usually just plays either by himself or with Colleen.
But he does know the numbers and the letters, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's
at the age of four, never having been to nursery school or play group or kindergarten or anything else. Where do you have your schooling?
We have a family room and a living room, and the family room is where the school desk is, where all the school books are. Usually one of the children sits for part of the time at the school desk and does their schoolwork, and then the kitchen table is used a lot, and Walter does his work when he has to really concentrate. He does his work up in his room at his desk.
People say to me, well, your daughter must have had teacher training, didn't she?
No, I didn't.
I remember one of the books that on homeschooling that you lent me, it said that the worst mother is probably better than the best teacher. Now, those would be fighting words to some of the teachers that might be listening to this program. And I'm sure that your primary object is not to denigrate the schools or the teachers, but just that you see that there are certain advantages. Mm-hmm. And I can see that it's working very, very well. It amazes me, as I say, that anything at all gets through with the distractions that they have. And yet last year when Walter and Elizabeth went to a school, mm-hmm. they both got outstanding student awards, didn't mm-hmm. they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's encouraging. People say, how much time does it take her? How mm-hmm. in the world does she have 8 hours a day mm-hmm. to homeschool?
Well, it doesn't take me 8 hours. It usually takes me about an hour to an hour and a half to prepare for the week, what they're going to do. And then each morning, the actual individual time that I give to them may be an hour to an hour and a half. I do try to read out loud part of that school time. So school for them is usually between 9 and 12. Walter, the oldest, does some schoolwork sometimes after lunch.
So don't they get bored with all that free time that they have?
Not at all. They're quite busy. The two girls are often busy writing letters to people. Walter is busy with his Boy Scout projects or a science project.
And then they do useful things around the house.
They do lots of chores around the house.
Like baking bread? Walter and Elizabeth.
They have baked bread, yeah.
Can bake bread. One of the most important things about homeschooling is that the child is never separated for any length of time from his parents up until whatever age he goes into school. And I never thought about this back when I was homeschooling you in the jungle, Val, but I remember when you did start to school, several of your teachers remarked to me that you were a very mature and well-adjusted and serene child compared to some of the others. Now, at the time, I attributed that to you, the fact that you were more an Elliot than you were a Howard. My maiden name was Howard. And I thought they had generally more easygoing personalities. Secondly, because you grew up with Indians who were serene and well-adjusted and relatively mature kids. But I never put two and two together until I read another book on the subject of jungle Indians' child training, which was written by a woman who had spent several years with Indians in Venezuela. And her observation was that it was the fact that they were never separated from their parents that made them so secure and so easygoing. And as you and I have often observed, the Indians were very genial, calm, humorous, easygoing, likable people. You didn't hear people arguing or screaming. You didn't hear them complaining. You never heard people fussing or making a big deal out of the bad weather or the hard work or the tough journeys. And I never really understood why that was. Now I'm beginning to think that it has a great deal to do with the fact that they have this strong, secure home base where the girls are always with their mothers learning to weave hammocks and make pots and plant manioc, and the boys are with their fathers learning to hunt mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. So would you agree that security is one of the most important
yes.
aspects of homeschooling?
Yes, I think because I want to be with my children, because I want them to be with me, they are happy and secure. Because Walter and Elizabeth went to a school last year, Elizabeth thinks that she's missing out from friendships. The only thing that she loved about school was being with friends. And so other people who really believe in socialization with peers would say, well, then she should be back in school so she can be with her friends. But I didn't see anything good that came from having her good friends. And so I want her to be at home just to learn the things that she learns at home, and that is responsibilities and taking your work seriously. And she does get together with friends, and so does Walter. She would like, if she had her own way, to have her own friend over every day, but she and Christiana, because they've had to play together, really play well together, and they're secure and happy in being together. And so I usually allow a friend over once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about government restrictions? Is it legal to homeschool your children in the United States?
Yes, it is. California is happens to be one of the states that's a little easier than some of the other states to homeschool in. We do not have to have a teaching certificate to teach them. If we were to be questioned by school authorities on what we were doing, we belong to a little homeschooling group called Saddleback Christian Academy, and they take care of our files and testing for the children. And so we would just refer the school authorities to that administrator of that school and say, we are doing what we're supposed to be doing.
Now, you said at one point that you spend most of the time just teaching the children grammar.
Mm-hmm.
How in the world do they learn mm-hmm. history and mathematics mm-hmm. and spelling?
Mm-hmm. So far, Walter has not come upon anything new that he already hadn't done in fifth grade. Apparently, he had an advanced math course in fifth grade, but he's got a sixth grade math book now, and he's still doing things that he had learned last year. When Elizabeth comes to something new, I just spend a little bit of time with her teaching her it. In fact, one thing it took her several days to catch a hold of, and it took Walter to teach her what it meant. I understood it, but I could not get through to her, and usually she's against Walter teaching her anything, but when Walter sat down and taught her how to do this particular thing, she learned it within 10 minutes. So when new things come up in the book, I do take the time to teach it, or Walter will do it. With Christiana, as I said, she's doing addition and subtraction just over and over again, and once in a while I sit down and do flashcards with her from memory. So when she comes to a new concept, I'll teach her that, and then she does her work on her own after that.
The Call to Motherhood, Part 10. Well, as we've just heard from Valerie, let's hear a little bit more from her. Oh, about 3.5 minutes more, as she talks about delayed obedience. Is there a personal story that you'd like to share, Valerie?
And I would just encourage moms and dads who have children at home, don't give up, no matter how difficult the child is. My youngest child, I have 4 very strong-willed, or my mother would say willful children, and I have 4 pretty compliant children. So as they were growing up, those 4 that were very willful were the difficult ones. But my youngest one was the most persevering, stubborn child of the 4. And my second one, Elizabeth, the mother of those 4 in England, was very, very persevering. But then Sarah came along as the last one. And I realized that because I knew she was going to be my last, my husband said we were done with having children. He's 9 years older than I. And I had to really discipline myself to seriously work with Sarah. And she is now a medical student, has been determined to be a doctor since she was about 7 years old. And we're very, very thankful and proud that she has that determined spirit. I remember one night I was trying to train her to sleep through the night because I had finished nursing her and she would wake up at exactly the same time she still had been nursed. She wanted to be nursed and I would just tell her, no, we're done. I'd give her water and I'd say, it's time to go back to sleep. But she'd wake up screaming, mad. And I went in and said, Mama has to spank you. And I believed in using a paint stick, which is the rod that is in Proverbs. I don't believe in beating a child. I believe in giving a good whack on the back of the leg and hard enough that hurts, but not to, you know, hurt them too much, of course. And parents have to be very careful with their own issue of anger and disciplining themselves to train their children rightly. So I had 3 nights in a row had gone in to deal with this screaming. I said, Sarah, if you wake up, you can call Mama if you want some water, but you're to go back to sleep. And after the little quick whack on the back of her leg, she would keep crying, but she wouldn't scream. I said, you cannot scream. But on the 3rd night, I was thinking, this isn't working. She's just not getting this. So Lord, is there something else I'm supposed to do? And you know what verse came to me? I knew it was the Holy Spirit. All discipline for the moment seems, in the King James, it says most sorrowful. It seems painful. But afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. And I knew that God was saying, persevere. You have to give her that spank again. And you know, it lasted maybe 2 more nights. She woke up, and after that, she slept through the night. So persevere with children that are very difficult, don't give up on teaching them to obey. They must understand authority. Parents can have the voice of authority with firmness and kindness. They do not have to be yelling. They do not have to be screaming at their kids. And if you say, I'm going to count to three, then you are training your children to delay obedience. And delayed obedience is disobedience.
Valerie Shepherd, daughter of Elizabeth. Well, our time together is coming to an end, but let me thank you for letting us come into your home. Maybe along with you, as you took a drive somewhere, wherever we found you today. On behalf of the Elizabeth Elliot Foundation, in cooperation with the Bible Broadcasting Network, let me invite you to check out elizabethelliot.org. elizabethelliot.org for more talks, devotionals, videos, and more Gateway to Joy programs. elizabethelliot.org. Ruby says, I love Elizabeth Elliot. I had to write a paper on her for school, so I listened to these podcasts. I really like them. And it's followed by, oh, maybe 30 to 40 hearts. Well, thank you, Ruby, for those comments. Hey, friend, let us hear from you sometime. That was from Apple Podcasts. But wherever you find us, leave a review sometime. Thanks. And until next time, may God remind you each and every day that you're loved with what kind of love? That's right. You are loved with an everlasting love. And underneath, let's say it together, underneath are the everlasting arms.